You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and our focus today is on the topic of freedom, one of the fundamental foundations of our country. Throughout our nation's history, and even in today's poisonous partisan divide, surely we can agree on what freedom means, can't we? Well, think again. My guest today has written an important book, a new book, that explores the meaning of freedom that is very timely in light of our current political battles. He's Jefferson Cowie, who holds the James G. Stallman Chair in History at Vanderbilt University. He's offered several books. He's been on Heartland Politics before. His latest book is called Freedom's Dominions, A Saga of White Resistance to Federal Power. And Jeff, welcome back and congratulations on this important book.
Thanks, Robin. It's great to be here again.
Well, for my opinion and for our listeners, I feel like Jeff's had a knack for selecting things out of American history that are for further exploration that are really illuminating on top of it all, they're relevant to today's politics. Your two most recent works, The Great Exception and Staying Alive, looked at the New Deal and the history of the working class, which to me are very fascinating and eye-opening, really. But how did you come to focus on this particular topic and the definition of freedom, I think, which again is so relevant to today's current political battles?
Well, that's a question with a lot of answers, actually. But the simple one is I began to think about different aspects of freedom as I experienced them personally, and I began to realize that not everybody shared what I believed it to be. And, you know, we have this old freedom from, freedom to kind of dichotomy, the freedom from oppression and the freedom to achieve things. The more I sort of looked around at this core value of an American history, the more I began to realize there were people actually who wielded this idea that actually scared me. It wasn't just a philosophical difference about how freedom functioned, but in fact, that people were using this as a way that was actually antithetical to what I thought of as freedom.
So we'll get into the heart of the book in a minute here, but you discussed the roots of this version of freedom in Jeffersonian politics. And Jefferson, of course, one of our revered founding fathers, one of the founders of the Democratic Party. What was the description of freedom that emanated from Jefferson that people latched onto?
Well, I might add he's also my namesake. So it's interesting. If we go back to the founding of the Republic, right, the American Republic, that this is a nation founded in a conversation with the ancient republics, right? The idea of a republic was a radical rebirth of an ancient idea. But that ancient idea, if we go all the way back to Athenian democracy, where the whole idea of freedom is born, we see that freedom is even then in a dialogue with slavery, that the idea of freedom emerges out of societies that are slave societies, and that you were free because you were not a slave. But then the next step, and this is the one that I'm investigating in this book, is it's not just the freedom to not be a slave, it's the freedom to enslave. And that's a kind of a quantum leap in how you think about this problem, right? Like, oh, you know, you think about freedom as just being not oppressed, but what about the freedom to oppress? And when we get to Jefferson, and you know, we just jump forward, you know, an enormous leap in world history, but he's thinking about, all the founding fathers are really thinking about these problems, but Jefferson's a slave owner, the founding sort of intellectual of American liberty, and somebody who believed deeply in land expansion, the expansion out west. And so he didn't really see freedom in slavery. I think he had a more complicated view of slavery, but he definitely saw the future of American freedom and autonomy and the ability to have a kind of freedom at the ballot box and to be that independent yeoman out west. And so when he makes a Louisiana Purchase, he calls it the Empire of Liberty. Right, that's where we will it's in western lands that we will be able to root the Republic's ideas of freedom, and that's a deeply problematic idea, because that means freedom, your freedom depends on stealing somebody else's land.
So we've really had this divide over freedom from the roots of the country, which, you know, people are aware of. We talk about the freedoms to vote, freedom of speech and all, but at the same time, our founders have enslaved people and were very limited really in democratic rights from the beginning. So you come up with this idea for the book to write about, which again is very timely, but I'm interested in how you came to select a certain location to focus on. You kind of told this through the story of one county and one region in the country, which really was kind of had a seat, front row seat, so to speak, to how this issue took place in our country's history right up until now.
Right. So when I, you asked earlier how I came to the idea of freedom, and part of it was I was interested in why people saw their freedom as antithetical to the federal government. That the federal government was a tyrannical usurper of local freedoms. And when I began to think about that, I realized, oh, you know what? I think this might work best if I ground it in a single place. And I could really tell the story of one place's ongoing historical tensions with federal power. And I hadn't gotten beyond that at all. I was just knocking around with this idea. And then I was teaching at Cornell University back then, and it was literally 20 degrees below zero. And my kids came to me and said, "Where are we going on spring break?" And I said, "We have no plans to go on spring break, kids." And they looked very forlorn. So I said, "Okay, you guys plan something and we'll do it. Just make it cheap." And so next thing I know, we're piled into our car, all four of us, and we're driving down to the Gulf Coast. And we get down to Southeast Alabama, and we start going through this town called Eufaula in Barber County in Southeastern Alabama, right on the Chattahoochee River on the border of Alabama and Georgia. And my spider senses just went off. I was like, this is the place. I want to tell the story of this place. It had a kind of, it had a magic they were selling, which is sort of a Moonlight Magnolias, Antebellum Mansion kind of, big boulevards kind of story, but I knew there was a much deeper story here. I didn't know what it was. So I decided, I went back to Cornell and started hitting the library and, finding out more about what this place was about.
And you start, the book's divided into four sections, four things that occurred in the history of Barber County in Alabama, starting with what we all know from our history books is the forced removal of Indians there. And again, this for our listeners to kind of, again, the way Jeff, our guest today, talked about this, again, the essential freedoms we have include, in this viewpoint, the freedom to enslave people. And how, I mean, I guess I think that's crazy, but this is how they came to this viewpoint, this belief, and had so much passion and energy behind it that they were forced to do some pretty bad things.
That's right. And so that sort of shock that you experience with this is really important, because when the white intruders into Creek lands begin to steal those lands that belong to the Muscogee Creek people, they do it in the name of their own freedom. And so this has often kind of just been dismissed as window dressing or, you know, political ideology on top of a naked land grab But I, the more I got into it, the more I realized, no, people actually, I think, define their freedom in this way. And then when the federal government comes in and tries to stop them from doing it, stop the white people from stealing Indian lands, which is kind of a weird cross current story that we're not really used to telling, then they both saw their freedom as the ability to steal this land and also the importance of fighting off federal power that was preventing them from taking the land. So it's really a kind of doubling down on this combination of anti-statist, anti-federal power freedom, along with the freedom to take indigenous people's lands.
And you follow that through. I'm going to kind of briefly go over this, and I really recommend our listeners get a copy of the book to follow this. The next part of the book deals with Reconstruction, and that we're probably more familiar with from our history books is just the federal government kind of almost losing interest in this topic and going away from it for a variety of reasons, including the corrupt bargain, a lot of other things. But this was where federal power made a difference at the beginning, and then it didn't.
That's right, and that's one of the core themes of the book is that federal intervention into local affairs, what is often regarded by local whites as federal tyranny or whatever, is absolutely instrumental to any kind of actual biracial or triracial or whatever number of racial democracy to be able to work. It requires rules and it requires enforcement. Otherwise, it's just, forms of local oppression. So the Reconstruction story is sort of, I mean, the removal story is fascinating, but the Reconstruction story really kind of amazed me. And you know, you're talking about the contemporary tie-ins. I think there are a few things more important right now to think about than Reconstruction, because I think that's where we see the importance of federal power in sort of a lost chance of actually making the Civil War about actual democratic, building a democratic culture and norms. So I can tell the story if you'd like, or
go right ahead.
Okay. during the Civil War, of course, whites went to war for their own freedom, to fight the tyranny of federal powers that was going to prevent them from the freedom to own slaves. And so, and they called themselves, that's how they called it, and that's how they saw it. And then after the Civil War, of course, under radical Reconstruction, federal troops are sent down and resources and rules are set. And at the point of federal bayonet, black political power is built. And this historically has gone down as a colossal mistake because we gave black people power that they were not capable of handling and all this sort of ideological baloney. What we actually see is a fairly rich, robust biracial democracy after the Civil War under the presence of federal troops. Well, whites in Barbara County did all sorts of shenanigans to get out from underneath this, all political ploys and trying to back political candidates that could unseat Ulysses S. Grant and all this stuff. And what it came down to was the election of November 1874. And the election of 1874, they decided they'd had enough and they... white people hid guns all over downtown Eufaula, and then at the appropriate moment, once all the black voters had marched in from the countryside, they opened fire on these voters that are lined up to elect people. And you have to remember, they'd elected a black congressman. There were black representatives to the state house. There was a white judge who was sympathetic to their cause. And so they opened fire on people and shot at least 80 people who were in line to vote in a hail of gunfire. Later on, the black voters found out that there were orders for federal troops to stand down and to not intervene in local affairs. So what you see there is like what happens when the federal government is not there to back up those rights.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. This is your host, Robin Johnson. My guest today is Jeff Cowie, who's the author of a new book called Freedom's Dominion, A Saga of White Resistance to Federal Power. We've been talking a little bit about some of the early parts of the book and the core message of this book on the topic of freedom, which, again, is so relevant today. Jeff and I were discussing a little bit before this the perfect example of freedom that both parties talk about now is couched in totally different issues. For the Democrats, it's freedom to choose and the abortion issue. For the Republicans, it's the freedom on gun rights and the Second Amendment. But this topic, this disagreement on freedom, has been throughout our country's history, and you would think we'd been able to agree on it, but I guess our current disagreements just reflect who we are as a people from the beginning. We've talked about the first two sections of your book. The third one gets into the New Deal era, the post-New Deal era. And the alarming, or I guess alarming may not be too strong a word, but the topic of lynching and how something odious, reprehensible as lynching, it becomes part of this philosophy of freedom too, that's the freedom people have to act, to do something as awful as that. I mean, that's what really made me have to put the book down for a little bit.
Yeah, well, imagine writing that book. It was actually an emotionally difficult book to write. And the lynching, the convict labor and the lynching chapters in particular were horrific to write and to research and to come across those primary documents where you saw this evidence of these most horrific acts. The chapter on lynching is called Lynching is an Act of Freedom. And that's a bone chilling title, I think, right? It's the most heinous acts of mob violence as an act of the most sacred principles of the American Republic. I think it's a very difficult idea to swallow, but acting with impunity, being able to take the life of another without any fear of recourse, it's the ultimate act of the freedom of domination, the freedom to oppress. And I think it fits, especially if you see the overall arc of the story all the way from Indian removal, say, to, you know, how it ends.
I think the final section gets into more modern times for me anyway, somebody at my age. And the key factor, the protagonist, is George Wallace. And I guess he fits in nicely into your narrative because he's from Barber County. Right. But this is where I think what's really interesting about your book is how he couches his feelings on race in terms of federal power, which were like code words, where he didn't have to talk about race as much. But you might talk a little bit about how his beginnings as a politician, which I've read before, where he was somewhat progressive on economic issues, but he certainly changed that after experiencing a loss.
That's right. Yeah, he saw himself as a bit of a protege of Big Jim Folsom, who's the progressive Alabama governor kind of a New Deal figure. But then after Brown versus Board of Education really brings a laser-like focus to the question of race relations, and he loses the governor's race. Because he's race baited from the right, he basically decides, okay, this is my ticket to power, is figuring out how to deal with this race issue. And there's a great quote about that, but it's really not repeatable. In polite company, right? That's what I was looking for. Just to go back to the beginning of our discussion, I didn't know Wallace was from the county when I first started studying it. I discovered that about 6 months in, and I was like, oh my God, this is fate, right? Because my earlier work all kind of has Wallace in it. And so Wallace learns this and then has the real master stroke, which race baiting is just simple, right? But he realizes his real battles with federal power, and he resists after the 1958 Civil Rights Act, a Civil Rights Act nobody even remembers exists. The Department of Justice demands the voting records for Barber County, and he refuses to give them, and became and fights the federal intrusion on local rights, and becomes known as the fighting judge. And this he rides all the way to the governor's mansion in Montgomery, basically as the resistor to federal power. And what we know about Wallace, the sort of, you know, textbook snippet of Wallace, of course, is his 1963 inaugural address, where he says, "Segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever," a line that's written by a Klansman, no less. But he only mentioned segregation one other time in that speech, and the rest of the speech is pretty much devoted, like 24 invocations of freedom or liberty. And the speech was actually about freedom from federal power. Because if you couch that in freedom from federal power, now you're not just getting the most reactionary races. Now you're getting people who don't want to pay taxes, people who don't want to be regulated, people who just don't like the federal government, people who are still fighting the lost cause. You get a much, much, everybody's got a beef against the federal government. The most progressive person in the world's got a beef against the federal government. And so now you got yourself a coalition. And that's what Wallace learned.
And I've read the story of George Wallace. Of course, he comes up north, and every time I read that, I keep thinking it'll have a different outcome, and it doesn't, which is still interesting. And it still talks about it. It talks directly to us about our politics today,
right?
And how Wallace, seemed to see it. He saw this, that the South, he talks about the Southernization of America, and that people up north were Southerners too. It wasn't a region, it was a state of mind.
That's right. Right. That's his great insight. The idea that the South's a state of mind. And he discovers this at Serb Hall in Milwaukee, where he goes up and talks to these, like, you know, boiler makers and machinists and stuff, and gets up there, and they start playing Dixie and Polish and giving him standing ovations and love everything he has to say. These are the core of the New Deal coalition, the white working class America. And they're hearing George Wallace and just can't get enough of him.
It seems to me that you can draw a line right from those voters, the Wallace voters, to the Ross Perot voters, to some of the Donald Trump voters, and even some of them that were for Obama and switched over to Trump. Trump's rhetoric seems to really echo George Wallace's. Is that a fair statement?
I think it's totally a fair statement. Yes. Yeah. I mean, and here you have men coming from completely different class positions, completely different regional positions and prerogatives, but both people are masters of kind of tossing ideas out, finding out what resonates with a mass of people, and hearing, not always knowing what it means or why, but sort of having this preternatural capacity to feel what an audience wants and give it back to them. And both those men can do that. And what they found resonated was this kind of this version of freedom that from federal power and the freedom to do whatever you want, no matter what anybody says or what norms it might violate. And I think Wallace was a more civilized version of it, actually.
Chapter 19 in the book, for our listeners that buy this, mark this down. I mean, it was very powerful for me. And permit me to read a little bit from it here, just a little bit. We're running out of time, but I have to do this. You talked about the quote, "the countless unknown dramas, internal conflicts, and attempts to draw federal power into the fight on behalf of local people, the untold dirt level fights that never became a part of history in unfamous, unfilmed, unknown places like Barber County, are where the majority of people experienced or failed to experience the Black freedom struggle," end quote. Beyond the TV lights and national focus, we all know of Selma. We know of Birmingham. We know of Memphis. We know of a lot of the Washington, March on Washington. But what you did, I think, is a credit to tell the story, one of those stories of a place that didn't get the headlines, and these took place everywhere, and these are the unsung heroes of the civil rights movement.
Well, that's right. And seeing those tiny local out of the way places, and what are they doing? What are they after? They're after federal citizenship. There's, you know, they don't want to be, these poor black people don't want to be citizens. I mean, they see themselves as people from Barber County and Alabamians and all that stuff, but they need federal citizenship in order to vote and to have civil rights. And the finding that really stunned me was when Martin Luther King's assistant, Hosea Williams, is going through all the tabulations about voter registration drives, and he can't figure out why some counties have good voter registration numbers and other counties don't, even though maybe the ones that have bad numbers have good leadership and good movements, like Barber County, actually. And finally, he finally figures out it's really simple. It was the counties with federal registrars present on the ground that had good registration numbers. So, you know, they can't do it on their own. You cannot fight this kind of idea of local freedom on your own. You need alliance with federal power. And I know federal power is sort of out of favor both on the right and the left, but I'm a champion of it.
It's still, there's still ground to be fought here and made up in this battle to this day. And, you know, one of the controversial decisions was the Shelby County ruling, which withdrew federal power from some places that had pass of racial discrimination in voting. And I think it's something that, you know, we still have to be very vigilant on, not just in the South, but some places up north here as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, it's a national problem. And my argument is really that federal oversight of these local elections is absolutely important. And the Holder decision was a terrible decision based on terrible ideas and evidence, and never should have happened. What we need is a much more vigorous version of the Voting Rights Act. We need everything. You know, I'm in favor of taking the whole question out of local and state level and making it federal. Thing of federal oversight. I realize I'm probably in the minority on that, but I walked away from all this research going, yeah, what we need to talk about is democracy. And what democracy is not necessarily about freedom. Democracy is about responsibility. It's about rules. It's about enforcement. It's about everybody gets rights, even if they conflict with yours. And that's a much more problematic, less fluid idea than is freedom. I think we're in the midst of a very long, slow moving redemption from the civil rights era, just like we had a long, slow moving redemption from Reconstruction. Redemption being a white elite term for turning the clock back on the civil rights gains during Reconstruction. And I think the same thing's happening now. We're not shooting voters in the streets as they were in Eufaula in 1874, but we are stripping them of their rights slowly and fairly efficiently, really. And if you throw in gerrymandering and other, you know, stripping convicts of their right to vote and other things, you're talking about the fight is now over, not over what we're voting about. The fight is over who gets to vote. And that's just not how you run a democracy.
Well, we're out of time. I didn't get to a couple other topics in the book, like the prison mines. You mentioned that. I would have liked to talk about that. But I'll just close with, again, for our listeners to go get a copy of this book. Again, it's called Freedom's Dominion, A Saga of White Resistance to Federal Power. Outstanding book. You know, you can think that you know a lot about history and all, but what I love about reading, especially Jeff's work, is I always find new things and different angles on things that make a lot of sense and with really good applications to today. Our guest has been Jefferson Cowie, the author of this book, and a friend. And Jeff, thank you again for coming on, and we'll look forward to your next work soon, I hope.
Well, good having you on. I can't wait to be back with another book.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.